With a looming food crisis on the horizon, countries around the globe elect populist leaders into office to be the voice of the people. This is Brief Before Impact. Hey, welcome everyone. I am Matt Parker. Thank you for joining us this evening. So tonight's topic, like I mentioned, it's going to be on populism. Well, what that actually means is it's a political movement, but we're going to be dissecting it and why it's growing around the world and other countries electing populist leaders and how it's so much of an effect of what the things we've seen around the world in the last 2 years, especially since COVID, and how one policy after another, both from the United States and other countries, have just compounded globally to seeing a new wave of politicians being elected and what potentially that could lead to in the future. So let me start off taking a quick ad break and then we'll get to work. All right, welcome back, everyone. So with a definition to kind of have a, all of us can be grounded in the same thinking, what populism actually is. Populism is a political movement that attempts to appeal to the people by convincing them that its leaders alone represent them and their concerns that are being ignored by the real or perceived elite establishment. This is according to ThoughtCo.com. Now, since the late 19th century, the label populist has applied to a range of politicians, political parties, and movements, often negatively by their opponents. So if we think about the growth in populism, think about in terms of timeline of the beginning of the COVID lockdowns. First, we had one, COVID happened. Then the country started to lock down under the basis of acquiring more data on how this virus is affecting people. Secondly, as we locked down across the world, the United States and globally, businesses were lost. They weren't going to ever come back. Government poorly managed the situation and supply chain issues developed. So now these things are compounding on top of one another. Then, in the example of the United States, the central bank and the government flooded the economy with cash and just increased the money supply, which caused inflation. I'm sure you've all noticed the higher gas prices and grocery prices. So with those high prices causing folks who are paycheck to paycheck, those individuals really starting to struggle, and now they're starting to place blame on the elected politicians, or in this case, the establishment, as it's called. And then populist candidates who want to represent the voice of the people, they run for office and they get elected. And so this is happening globally. And a few key takeaways to what populism is as a political movement, it promotes that idea that its leaders alone represent the people in their struggle against the elite establishment. Populist movements and political parties are often led by charismatic, dominant figures who represent themselves as the voice of the people. And they're found both on the right and the left in the political spectrum. And when they are referred to negatively, populism is sometimes accused of encouraging authoritarianism. This is something certainly that Donald Trump was accused of. Not necessarily it played out in his policies, but it was more his persona, and that his critics were often would blame him for this authoritarian tendencies. So lastly, populist movements are often led by those kind of charismatic figures who claim to act as the voice of the people. And for example, to January 2017, in his inaugural address, President Donald Trump, who was a self-proclaimed populist, stated, "For too long, a small group in our nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government while the people have borne the cost." So essentially, this is what populism is, and that's why, as we can think about global issues from the time COVID onward, why it has grown in such popularity. And I'll give you a few examples across the world of how the not just the instance of COVID, but as well as the recent invasion of Ukraine has caused the local population to rise up against the elite in frustration. So, for example, according to Reuters, the war in Ukraine and drought fueled by climate change has sent global prices for grains, cooking oils, fuel, and fertilizer soaring. Rising prices for basic food staples is fueling protests from Indonesia to Iran. European wheat prices have jumped 52% And palm oil futures have gone up 25% since January. Think about that for a moment. As a, like a hypothetical number, you're paying a dollar per pound for wheat. Now it's $1.52. And I compound that across other inflation prices. This is a tremendous problem. So the trend is growing and is alarming policymakers. The United Nations agencies are warning that the price hikes will worsen an existing food crisis in Africa and could cause catastrophic child malnutrition. So here's a few countries just to highlight their local issues that have compounded from COVID, lockdowns, supply chain issues, and now the invasion in Ukraine. Argentina, thousands of farmers protested in Buenos Aires on April 23rd against the President Alberto Fernandez, whose policies to contain food prices to curb rampant inflation have been criticized by the agricultural sector. Chile, thousands of students marched through the Chilean capital, Santiago, on March 25th, demanding higher food stipends. Cyprus, Cypriot farmers dumped tons of milk and lit bales of hay outside the presidential palace in the capital of Nicosia on May 18th in protest at higher prices and production issues. Lastly, Greece had thousands of workers protesting in Athens in the May Day rallies against a surge in energy and food prices. Greece's annual consumer inflation accelerated to 8.9% in March, hitting its highest level in 27 years. So those are just a couple of highlights of the issues around a couple of countries. And these are mostly responses to the increasing prices of different commodities that people depend on a daily basis. Now, as a result of the larger economic challenge that has faced so many countries have faced in the last few years, how does the government of a country respond to uprisings and protests? We have the United States context. We're pretty familiar with that. I want to give you a few examples of how other countries differ. I'm going to point out Iran specifically. UN human rights experts have expressed serious concern about violent crackdown against civil society in Iran, including members of worker unions and teachers arrested for protesting against their low salaries and poor working conditions, and urge those responsible for using excessive force to be held to account through comprehensive and independent investigations. This is according to OHCHR. Quote, "We are alarmed at the recent escalation of allegedly arbitrary arrest of teachers, labor rights defenders, and union leaders, lawyers, human rights defenders, and other civil society experts," according to the experts they say. And now in this past year, for example, the Iranian Teachers Trade Association, they've organized several nationwide protests on over working conditions and low wages, as well as to protest the arrest of teachers and restrictions on public education for all. Now, a direct quote from these experts, "The crackdown comes in the context of an extremely dire economic situation, which the authorities themselves have acknowledged. We recall that the government is the primary duty bearer in the protection and promotion of human rights, including by mitigating the impact of sanctions. We call these authorities to address the underlying causes of protests and ensure that everyone can exercise their rights, freedom of expression, association, and peaceful assembly." This is such a challenge that countries across the world will always face. If you can imagine boiling water in a pan on the stovetop, the water and the temperature are the people that are starting to get hotter and hotter as these kind of issues, economic issues, energy prices, the cost of wheat, as those things become more of a challenge to the people, they get fed up and need someone to point the blame at. And rightfully so, they have to point the blame at the leaders that they've elected political office, or in the case of some countries, they haven't elected. So as a government, and each type of government takes a different stance on how to handle such protests, they are responsible to turn down that temperature, to lower it. In the case in certain countries, human rights are not as prioritized as in other countries. Particularly, they're prioritized more in Western-style democracies than they are in the example of a country such as Iran. Not defending all the actions of Western democracies by any means, but to point out there are substantial differences in how they treat people protesting. I wanted to highlight two terrific examples of populism and how it's going to shift the national politics of a country moving forward. I'll start with France, and we're going to finish with Colombia. So for France, if you've been paying attention to France politics, you probably have heard this name. There's two names. One is their current president. His name is Emmanuel Macron. And then another politician, Marine Le Pen. what has happened recently, as Macron has positioned himself as kind of a center left politician, Marine Le Pen has overtly come out as very conservative, a very right of the political spectrum. What happened recent elections in France is that whereas her political party had very few, if any, or very small representation in the parliament, has had tremendous gains in their most recent elections, which is going to have a tremendous impact on Macron's, I should say, his ability to portray himself not just as a strong political leader in France, but even more so the position he really wants to take as kind of the central unifying figure of European politicians. According to Politico and Breitbart, Marine Le Pen's National Party shattered a glass ceiling in Sunday's French legislative elections with an 11-fold increase to 89 seats that gives the party unprecedented power in the incoming National Assembly. Now, with 89 ministers, not only has Le Pen been resurrected after keeping a low profile following her loss from Macron, but the resurgent of far-right party will become a parliamentary group for the first time since 1986. The far-right party, which only had 8 ministers in the last makeup of the French lower chamber, because it had fallen short of that 15-seat threshold that you have to have to reach a foreman parliamentary group in the last term. These ministers who are not in groups have less speaking time, less means, and less say in how the assembly actually operates. Basically, since you have your party has fewer people, you don't really get that much of a say. Groups, and now their recent growth in their election, roundly rebuking his neoliberal globalist political philosophy, the French public has refused to grant President Macron a parliamentary majority, as Marine Le Pen's populists on the right and ecological alliance on the left surged at the ballot box to strip the once self-described Jupiterian leader of his ability to govern France firmly. Now, going forward, it will now be much more difficult for President Macron to enact the agenda on which he stood for, stated goal of cutting taxes, as he will likely be needed in Paris to focus on waging wars on the domestic front, forging alliances in the National Assembly, if he has any chance of passing his agenda items. The beleaguered president will most likely need to turn to the center-right less Republicans, meaning Macron may need to shift to the right to pass legislation. The loss of this parliamentary majority may also see Macron diminished on the world stage. With hopes now dashed of retaining a governing majority, it remains to be seen how effective Macron will be at casting himself as the premier leader in Europe. So if you imagine kind of a one step after the other that led from a really an almost non-existent far-right political party to exploding on the stage, this is an example of the draw and the attractiveness of populism, especially when it would appear that the established elites are not fulfilling their roles to the people themselves. At the end of the day, I think most people around the world, with some exceptions, obviously, want more or less the same thing. They want to have a good job, live in a safe community, watch their kids grow up. More or less, I'm giving the bullet points, but that's really about most life. Again, with exceptions. And whenever people feel like that's not working for them, they have to say, well, what's changed? Who have I put in charge to allow the biggest changes in my life as an individual? And they point to the politicians. And there is that perception that the individuals who grow to the same fancy schools, grow up in the same rich neighborhoods and so forth, don't actually have the finger on the pulse of the people who they're elected to represent. This is where populist leaders, as a political movement, take advantage of that sentiment and gain their own power. Now, pivoting from France over to Colombia, a tremendous change has happened in that country and come more broadly into Latin America. This is according to the France 24 and the Wall Street Journal. Colombians have elected a new president, Gustavo Petro. He's 62 years old, and he's set to become the first leftist in the country's top job. The former rebel of the now defunct M19 movement, that was a communist movement back in the 80s, that's another topic. He was a millionaire businessman as well. Rodolfo Hernandez in Sunday's election. So he has beat that former millionaire. Now, Petro will take the oath of office in August, replacing the deeply unpopular Iván Duque. Pointing out here that voters in the U.S.'s closest ally in Latin America have now elected a president as a former leftist guerrilla. And he says he wants to phase out oil and mining, overhaul the U.S.-backed drug war, and renew relations with Venezuela's regime. These are tremendous changes, especially in the context of American foreign policy leaders. Colombia joins Argentina, Chile, Peru, Mexico, and some smaller countries that have elected leftist leaders in the last 4 years, whose policies sometimes are at odds with Washington's interest in Latin America. So these leftist leaders of countries from Chile to Mexico often have diverging positions with each other on issues ranging from climate change to abortion to relations with Washington. Now, for example, Mexico's president is conservative on social issues, while Chile's young leader wants to legalize abortion and support transgender rights. Mr. Petro for Colombia wants to transition from fossil fuels. The leftist frontrunner ahead of Brazil's October presidential election, Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, he hails his country as an oil power, and the way they deal with the U.S. varies from the past. So though largely swept into office in a wave of anti-incumbent sentiment stoked by the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, the new leaders now face mounting inflation, low economic growth, and rising deficits, and their budgets are far from flush. This is what's most interesting to point out in my mind about populist leaders. They ride this wave, the sentiment that the establishment is not working for them. So they ride this wave to getting elected to power, saying they're going to be the voice of the people. In this case, for all these Latin America leaders, what are they inheriting? Right off the bat, they're facing inflation, low economic growth, rising deficits. And those are caused from many factors, and just not to include COVID and the lockdowns and now this the war in Ukraine. They come into power with a message saying they are the voice of the people, but they still have to deal with these issues. So indeed, despite rising prices on everything from oil to copper, which helped generate about 7% rebound growth last year, the outlook for the year and the next is grim. For example, the World Bank estimates Latin America is just going to grow 2.3% this year and 2.2% in 2023. That doesn't mean that the U.S. doesn't have serious challenges, particularly in countries where the issues that have mattered most to Washington, such as drugs and migration, are most serious. And this is, you know, putting that hat back on, thinking about America's perspective in Latin America. Now that you have all these countries electing leaders who certainly not aligned with our policy hopes for the region, we have to consider from a diplomatic standpoint, a military engagement standpoint, of how do we engage with countries who are electing leaders riding on that populist sentiment, and how do we still encourage at that more national and multilateral level engagement with the biggest economy in the world, as well as still solving those local issues, not trying to kind of let go of, as these Latin American leaders, not trying to let go of, like, they are the voice of the people, but they still have to engage with the global powers and make deals at the end of the day. And this is a struggle, I think, for people around the world wanting to say, well, why can't my leader just do X, Y, or Z? The reason is the leaders operate in a multifaceted world that has a lot of players, a lot of interest. So they're constantly having to make deals that are, in fact, bending their own principles just to do so. And this is, you never get what you want. And this is a matter of the United States or another country for that matter, because you are a part of the global process, whether it's from an economic standpoint of globalization or a military confrontation. It's never just going to be, you know, team A versus team B, and here's how we win. There's all these other influences on those issues that make it a less than ideal situation, or for at least the voters, but they have to grasp the fact that this is the world they're trying to inhabit. So with that being said, I think from a rising populism across the globe, we'll see in our own country and abroad for that matter, politicians that are saying, I represent the voice of the people, and I want to get back to just the basics of living daily life. We've all gone through the challenges of COVID. Now we're all seeing rising inflation, obviously this war in Eastern Europe, and the unknown of how that will play out. You will see more leaders, in my view, resort back to, you know, our country, our citizens first, and then we can engage abroad as a second goal. but the United States will continue to have to pull back and forth between the political left and political right of how it sees itself as a leader around the world amidst all these populist politicians being elected to office. Because there, I think there is balance. There's a ground that we can strike there where we can have supporting the goals of, you know, a country and a region that we have an interest in and still maintaining the leadership economically, militarily, that we've inherited since, you know, essentially post-World War II. But again, it kind of comes back to as a almost a political philosophical question. What is the United States standing for as it engages abroad now, especially with these new types of leaders coming to office? I hope you enjoyed this episode on the glowing populism around the world. As always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker, and this is Brief Before Impact.